Tonight we're going to look at the entire Bible. Now, in these meetings the past several years, I've been meeting once a month, we've been trying to cover a whole book of the Bible in one meeting, and that's been a challenge. Sometimes it's taken two sessions in one night, and sometimes it's taken two sessions two months in a row, so it's been like four sessions to get through one book. Now we're going to get through the whole Bible in one session. That's my plan. I don't know if I can say it's my promise. It's my plan that we will cover the whole Bible tonight. Now, there's notes on your chair. Hopefully, they'll be helpful to you. The thing about the Bible is that it covers a lot of time, a lot of history. It's a narrative. It has different kinds of material in it, but the majority of the material in it are historical narrative. The Old Testament, from Genesis through Esther, is historical narrative. And there's even some historical narrative found in some of the prophets, a few chapters here and there, are historical narrative there. So as it comes down to the majority of the Old Testament, a small majority, is historical narrative. And the parts that are not, like the Psalms and the Proverbs and the prophets, they fit into the narrative. I mean, the prophets lived at certain times during that narrative. And, when you read, that Isaiah prophesied during the time of Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, well, that's how he opens his book. But if you don't know anything about the history, you think, okay, those are just foreign names to me. I don't know when that was. You know the history, you know more about when Isaiah lived and what he was talking about and what was going on. Same thing with Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived 100 years later, but he's in the narrative too. Everything in the Old Testament is either the narrative itself or books that can be inserted at proper places in the narrative. And once you see the whole narrative, it's really great. It's really helpful. Because then when you read any part, you realize that some things that you're familiar with happened before that, some after, and so on. New Testament, likewise, is more historical narrative than anything else. The majority of the books in the New Testament are actually epistles. But the epistles are relatively short compared to the historical books. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all longer than any of the epistles. And Acts, then, is a very long book, too. So when you add those up, those first five books, they make up more than half of the New Testament. So more than half of the Old and more than half of the New is historical narrative. And that's what we're going to review, the historical narrative. Now, putting it in historical perspective, of course, we know it begins at the beginning of the world in Genesis. And where it ends, perhaps nobody knows, because nobody knows the day or the hour, and the times and the seasons are not for us to know. But the end has not come yet, although the historical narrative doesn't reach our time. The historical narrative ends in the first century. In fact, we could say that the historical narrative of the Old Testament covers about 4,000 years. The historical narrative of the New Testament covers about 40 years. So the Old Testament covers like 100 times the length of time. When I say 40 years, I'm not including the birth narratives of Jesus. There's a few couple chapters at the beginning of Matthew, a couple at the beginning of Luke, where Jesus is born and a baby. But the rest of both Matthew and Luke, and also all of Mark and John, are about Jesus' adult ministry, which was, I'm going to say, started around 27 A.D. And that's and then, of course, the story ends with Paul in prison in 67 A.D., so or earlier. So that's only 40 years of history recorded in the New Testament, as opposed to 4,000 years of history in the Old. Now, when I give you year numbers and gaps and so forth, I'll just say I'm being approximate. When it comes to very ancient events, not all scholars agree on the exact dates of them. For example, the end of the Babylonian exile is sometimes said to be in 539 B.C. Others say 538 B.C. Okay, it's a give or take a year. Now, I'm going to use numbers more often than not that are give or take a century, because there are different opinions about when some of these things started and when they ended. But scholars would all be pretty much in agreement in saying, well, this happened in the middle of the 9th century B.C. sometime. Okay, so I'm going to give you numbers, but just realize I'm not giving you exact numbers. I'm not pretending to. Some of the numbers will be exact, but mostly we're talking about to the nearest century. Less than a century, but when you're talking about periods of millennia, you still get reasonably close when you get the right century. Now, from the creation of the world to our day is a period of about 6,000 years, judging from the genealogies in Genesis 5 and in Genesis 11. Now, the genealogies in Genesis 5 start with, Adam, his first, when he's 130 years old, had Seth, and when Seth, and then after he had Seth, he lived another 800 years, and he died at 930 years. It does that with each generation. Seth gives that information to him, and the next, there's 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And the numbers of years that each man lived from the time he was born till he had his first son is given in every case. Now, you can add up those years. And assuming there are no gaps in the genealogy, and I will say this, we can't always assume that there are no gaps, but if we go by only the numbers that are recorded for us, then the earth, or man at least, was created about 4004 B.C. Now, Jesus was born about 4 B.C. Now, if you say, well, I thought Jesus would be born about 0 B.C., isn't B.C. mean before Christ? Well, it does, but the first reckoning of when Jesus was born, which was done several centuries after his death, some scholars worked out when they think he was born, they miscalculated his date of birth. And so the division between B.C. and A.D. Was off by a few years. And the reason for that, the reason we know that, is because Herod the Great died in the year that traditionally is called 4 B.C., and yet Jesus was born before Herod died. Herod is the one who sent the armies to kill all the babies in Bethlehem to try to kill Jesus, who had been born. And the wise men came to Herod and asked where he's born. So Herod was still alive when Jesus was born, and Herod died in 4 B.C. Some people would say Jesus was born maybe as early as 6 B.C. We don't know. But we know that the traditional A.D.-B.C. division is not correct. Someone got it wrong hundreds of years ago and decided. But the year that would traditionally be called 4 B.C. is the earliest year we know of that Jesus lived and was born. It could have been born a couple of years earlier. We don't know. That's why I'm saying we're being not exact in some cases. Likewise, Jesus' ministry probably began in 27 A.D., the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. Luke tells us it was the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, so that's a good indicator. And so Jesus probably died at around 30 A.D., maybe 31. Some people say 33. But again, we just don't know. We don't know the exact dates. So that's why I'm going to say, I'm going to give you general dates. From the time of Adam's creation, about 4,000 or 4,004, as Bishop Usher said, years before Christ, till the time of Christ is clearly 4,000 years, approximately. Now, again, I will say this. This can be challenged on the basis that some people think that man was created a lot longer ago than that. I don't think there's any necessity of saying so, but there are people who don't trust the Bible as much as I do and who would trust other, secular records more. And they might say, well, the Egyptians have their histories going back. The Chinese have their king list going back further than that. So they say, the people were created a lot longer ago than 4,000 years before Christ. Frankly, I trust the Hebrew records written by the prophets more than I trust the pagan records written by Egyptians and Chinese. So that's just me. You got to pick who you're going to trust. And so I'm going to go with the dates that we can calculate from Scripture. If you say, well, I don't think those are accurate, I'm not going to fight you for that. I'm just going to say I'm working with the material we actually have. Now, I will say this. It could be longer ago than 4,000 B.C. because it could be argued that the genealogies are not complete, that there are generations that are left out, that just the high points of a genealogy are given, and not the, and that when it says so-and-so, in such a year he begat so-and-so, the word begat means became the father of, or possibly, as the Bible uses the word father, as an ancestor, in this year the man became the ancestor of this man. Well, that means that the second man, looks to the previous man as his ancestor, but maybe not his direct father. And therefore, there might be any number of generations we don't know about. And in favor of seeing it that way, we know that Matthew gives the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1 through 16. And he divides Jesus' genealogy from Abraham to Jesus into three sets of 14 generations. But that's because the number 14 had symbolic value to the Jews. Matthew was not trying to give a total number, because anyone can see by reading it that to make three groups of 14, David has to belong to the second group and the third group. David has to be the last of the first group, the last of the second group of 14, and he's also the first one in the third group of 14. So Matthew's not being mathematical. He's being more using more symbolic numerology. And we know there's at least four kings who reign sequentially in the Old Testament who are mentioned in the books of Kings and Chronicles that Matthew just leaves out. He jumps from one of them to another king who's his great-great-great-grandson. So we know that it's not unheard of for Jewish genealogies to leave out generations. And that's their business. And we Westerners are more mathematical. We're more technical. We're more engineering-oriented. We want the right numbers. We want the total numbers. We want to know the actual figures. Ancient people, they were less interested in that. They wanted to point the family line out, and whether you leave a few generations out or not, it's still the same line. So if I were one trying to point out that I was descended from the Pilgrims, which I don't think I was. My mom would know more than I. She was alive then, but no, she was not. She was not alive then, but she has our genealogies somewhere. But if I wanted to prove I was descended from Pilgrims, I wouldn't have to document every person. But, I could give you my grandfather and my grandfather's grandfather and maybe his great-grandfather, and we could go back to the Pilgrims and say, see, I came directly from them. And that would be legitimate if all I'm trying to prove is that my ancestry goes back to the Pilgrims. Now, if I'm trying to give you a thorough genealogy, I'd do it a different way. But no one can require ancient Jewish people to have the same priorities that we have in their genealogies. They wanted to prove, for example, Matthew wanted to prove that Jesus came from Abraham and from David. Those are the important things. Messiah had to come from Abraham. He had to come from David. It doesn't matter how many of the genealogies the generations you leave out, especially when your whole audience knows about those ones you're leaving out. I mean, it's not like Matthew's trying to pull a fast one. I'm going to leave out these four. No one will notice. No, they're kings that are listed in the Old Testament. Certainly the Jews knew about it. They're just not trying to be complete. And some say, well, the 10 generations from Adam to Noah might have left some out too. Who knows how many? So, I mean, there are people who would dispute, even people who believe the Bible would dispute maybe the traditional dating of the creation of Adam 4,000 years before Christ. But those are the only numbers we have. Those are the numbers we'll work with. The interesting thing is that there is a 4,000 years from Adam to Christ. But that 4,000 years is divided in the exact middle. 2,000 years after Adam, 2,000 years before Christ, by Abraham. Now that's interesting. I mean, the Bible writers couldn't have planned it that way. I mean, it's too complex to work it out. For one thing, the Old Testament writers didn't know when Jesus would be born. So they wouldn't have fabricated the numbers in order to anticipate Jesus would be born when he was. They didn't know when he'd be born. It just works out that way. That right in the middle of Old Testament history, right smack dab between Adam and Christ, is Abraham, who is the most significant Old Testament character. Now, what's interesting is all the 2,000 years before Abraham, the first half of that Old Testament period, are covered in 11 chapters. Genesis chapter 1 through 11 covers the first 2,000 years. The rest of the Old Testament covers the other 2,000 years. which shows the relative importance of Abraham. That the writers give us only 11 chapters on the first 2,000 years, but after Abraham, everything is so important because of him and his seed that they go into, it takes, 38 books of the Bible to cover that. And so Abraham's a very pivotal turning point. And his story begins in chapter 12 of Genesis, verses 1 through 3, with what's called the Abrahamic covenant. Now, before Abraham, in that first 2,000 years, there were four major events. So creation, fall, flood, Tower of Babel. Those were all events that affected the whole world. And those are the only events of the first 2,000 years that the Bible cares to even talk about. I mean, it does talk about Cain killing Abel, but that's not really a world-changing thing. It just affected two men and their families. But anyway, the world-changing events, there were four of them in the first 2,000 years. Now, there are a lot more important events in the next 2,000 years. Now, the 2,000 years from Abraham to Christ is divided right in half by another significant person. 1,000 years after Abraham and 1,000 years before Christ, David lived. Now, interestingly, the most important prophecies about the Messiah was that he descends from Abraham and from David. And that's how Matthew begins, the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of Abraham, the son of David, and gives the genealogies there in Matthew chapter 1. But it's interesting and not necessary, but apparently just it'd be a tremendous coincidence if throughout history, Old Testament history before Christ was divided in half by the life of Abraham, and then the remaining part was divided in half by the life of David. So this is how the Old Testament is divided. And now we're going to talk about the story, but I just want you to see kind of the general relative timelines. Now, of course, since the time of Jesus, it's been 2,000 years now. Which means there was 2,000 years from Adam to Abraham. There's 2,000 years from Abraham to Christ, and 2,000 years from Christ till now. A total of 6,000 years. And once again, I'm not willing to go to the mat about whether Adam was literally created 4,000 years before Christ. That's the only numbers we have. If there's more numbers that we weren't given, other generations not mentioned, it doesn't matter to me. I don't care if he was created a million years ago. I'm saying that from the narrative itself, we read only of Adam being created 2,000 years before Abram. Then Abram was 2,000 years before Christ. And that period between Abram and Christ was divided in half by David's life, who was very significant. All right, so those are some things. You have timelines I've given out. I will just talk about the story. So the whole history of man, by this reckoning, is about 6,000 years. And the Old Testament covers, therefore, about two-thirds of that history. The first 4,000 out of 6,000 total years was Old Testament history before Christ. And I mentioned those distances from Adam to Christ is 4,000. That period is divided by Abraham right in the middle. And the period from... Now, Noah, of course, came before Abraham. And we have some more genealogies with some more numbers in them. From Adam to Noah was 10 generations recorded. From Noah to Abraham was 10 generations recorded. And the symmetry there is another reason some people suspect maybe these are not comprehensive genealogies. I mean, they could be. They could be just a coincidence that the period from Adam to Noah was the same number of generations, not the same length of time, but the same number of generations as from Noah to Abraham. Or, like Matthew divided Jesus' genealogy into three equal groups of 14, Moses might have edited the genealogies down to the major names, left out less important names that are in their generations, and made it 10 and 10. If that is what happened, then all bets are off, about how long that period was. But we don't have any reason to suggest a different length of time, since these are the numbers we had. Now, the first third of history, of course, was from Adam to Abraham. And as I said, that covered in Genesis 1 through 11. The next third of history is from Abraham to Jesus. This is covered in the remainder of the Old Testament. and then the 2,000 years from Abraham to Jesus is divided in half by David. I've given you all that information. I'm just now looking at the notes for the first time, and we're going to go through the Old Testament first of all. Genesis 1 through 11 has the creation, the fall, the flood, and the Tower of Babel. And that's about all there is there. And that covers the first half of Old Testament history. Then Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, God makes a covenant with Abram, which is recorded there, the promise that through him all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed through his seed. And the rest of the entire Bible, including the New Testament, are unpacking that promise. Because the promise was made that Abraham's seed would bless all nations. Well, initially, Abraham's seed was conceived to be the Jews. Abraham was the great-grandfather of Jacob, whose name was Israel also. And Israel's 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. And the nation we think of as Jews today, we were called Israel in that time, they were the seed of Abraham. And therefore, the story of Israel becomes the Old Testament narrative. We have, you know, just incidental references to other nations as they related to Israel, as they came into Israel's history and were relevant. But even great nations like Egypt and Assyria and Babylon, which ruled the world, are only mentioned in the Bible insofar as they have any connection with Israel. Because being a great empire, remembered in history as a great, powerful empire, is not as important to God as being the people that God is working his plan through. Now, what was the plan? To bring the blessing of Abraham to all nations. Now, it never happened through the Jewish people directly. And so the story of the Old Testament tells about more or less about their failure. But when you come to the New Testament, we're told that the seed of Abraham is Jesus. And of course, for the past 2,000 years, from Jesus to our time, the whole world has been exposed to the gospel. Not every last person, but every nation has been penetrated with missionaries. The gospel is preached throughout the world, and people have received the blessing of Abraham through Abraham's seed, Jesus. What's the blessing of Abraham? According to Galatians 3, it is being justified by faith. Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness, Paul says. And he says that's the blessing of Abraham, being justified by faith. And that blessing has come to the whole world through Jesus. So the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise, which begins in chapter 12 of Genesis, it is developed through the rest of the Old Testament and the story of Jesus and the rest of history. Everything after Abraham is about Abraham, or at least about the promises God made to Abraham and God fulfilling them. So that's why people are so interested in Israel, because Israel's the only center of focus in the Old Testament. And Jesus lived and died in the context of the nation of Israel. And even the early church began in Israel. Now, it eventually spread to all nations, but Israel is definitely center stage in the Old Testament and the early New Testament times. And that's why people are, you know, even today, people say Israel is very important. There's people who say, if you want to know where we stand in the whole purpose of God, we need to look at Israel. Now, not everyone agrees with that, because the view that the church held most of history is that when Jesus came, the nation of Israel was then obliged to follow him and become what we call the church. And they did. The faithful remnant did. The apostles were Jews. The early Christians in Jerusalem were Jews. And they followed Jesus. That's what the whole nation should have done. Only the faithful remnant did. But in the New Testament, whoever isn't following Christ is not one of God's chosen people, because Christ is the chosen one. And we are chosen by being in him. We share in his chosen status. And so today, the nation of Israel contains, as it always has, a faithful remnant who do follow Christ, and the rest who don't. The ones who do are the children of Abraham. Paul said in Galatians 3:29, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise that God made to Abraham. So if you are Christian, if you're in the Messiah, you are the seed of Abraham and you're the heirs of the promise God made to him. Well, what about the Jews who aren't in it? Well, they're just like Gentiles who aren't in it. There's no Jew or Gentile in Christ or out of Christ. Jew and Gentile cease to be relevant theological categories as soon as Jesus came. and Jews who followed Jesus, which was the original Christians, became the significant factor. The rest of the nation was pretty much wiped out by the Romans in 70 AD and has never really fully recovered from that, even though there's a nation over there now that bears that name. But we're not going to get into that controversy. We're just going to talk now about from Abraham's son on. What happens? The period of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Of course, Abraham's chosen son was Isaac. His chosen son was Jacob. And in this case, in choosing Isaac, Ishmael, also a son of Abraham, was not chosen. And six other sons of Abraham that we know very little about, whom he had by another woman named Keturah. Altogether, Abraham had eight sons. But the only one that was the chosen seed was Isaac. And then Isaac had two sons, and only one of them was chosen, not Esau, but Jacob. And Jacob later is called Israel. Now, Israel, Jacob, had 12 sons. And these later became the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Their dad was Israel, so they were the children of Israel. Later, you drop the children part, and they're just called Israel in the rest of the Bible, for the most part. So that Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And the reason I mention him is because the story focuses on him in the latter 10 or more, 12, maybe 13 chapters of Genesis. It's all about Joseph and his relation with his brothers and his dad in Egypt and so forth. But that whole period, we call that the patriarchal period because these were the fathers. Patriarch means father. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 patriarchs. That's the patriarchal period of Israel's history. They were not a nation then. There was no nation of Israel. There was a family, all brothers of one man, the sons of one man, and his name was Israel, so their family was called Israel, but they weren't a nation. They were just a big family. Now, as such, they were taken down into Egypt because of a famine in their own land, and that story is told at the end of Genesis. That patriarchal period lasted for about, what do I have down here? How many years was that? It was, from 1921 BC till 1635 BC. So that's about 300 some odd years, 325 years. That was the patriarchal period of those four men. And by the way, just as the first 11 chapters of Genesis have four main events, the remainder of Genesis has four main men. From chapter 12 through 50 in Genesis, you've got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then primarily Joseph. Now, when you come to Exodus, things have changed. The 12 sons of Jacob, but Jacob is dead, Joseph's dead, the first generation that went down to Egypt are dead, but their descendants have grown into a very large ethnic group. They're still not a nation, they're not a political entity, they're just a family, but they became so large and so quickly growing that the Pharaoh was terrified that they might outnumber him and do something harmful to his people, so he put them in chains. He put them under bondage. And they remained in bondage for some hundreds of years. Some people would say it was 430 years. That number is given in the Bible. But when you look at it, it may include some of the period before they were actually in Egypt. I won't get into that controversy now. There's a case that can be made that the time they were actually in bondage in Egypt was only half that period, 215 years. But still, it's a long time. It's several generations. And it's hard. It was hard bondage. And so the book of Exodus through Deuteronomy are the story of Moses. And Genesis, with these other four books, make up what we call the Pentateuch, what the Jews call the Torah. It's the law. Genesis through Deuteronomy, the first five books, Moses wrote them, and the Jews called them the Torah. Christians usually call them the Pentateuch, which means five books. Now, of those, only Genesis covers history before Moses' time. Exodus through Deuteronomy covers the life of Moses. He's born early in Exodus. He dies at the end of Deuteronomy. And Moses' career was that he was, of course, born to the slave community of Hebrews in Egypt at the time when the Pharaoh was persecuting them and frightened of them. And Moses was spared by being hidden by his mother and found by the Pharaoh's daughter, who took an interest in him and decided to raise him. So he was raised as royalty in Egypt. But he was aware somehow of his Hebrew connections. Well, this is probably because although the daughter of Pharaoh found him as a baby and wanted to adopt him, she needed someone to wet nurse him. So it turned out that Moses' mother was hired by Pharaoh's daughter to nurse and to wean the child. So in those years that he's been weaned, probably his mother said, "Hey, you're one of us. You know, don't forget us. We're in, you know." She knew he was going to grow up in the palace. She probably, you know, wheels were turning and thought, "Well, my son's going to be royalty here. He's going to be in a position to help us out here. We're slaves." And so she probably planted those things in his head when he was very little. And even since she weaned him, she may have been allowed to visit him throughout his childhood too. So she may have had influence on him. But somehow we know when he came to age, at age 40, he knew he was a Hebrew. He went down to visit the Hebrews. He saw an injustice done to the Hebrews by an Egyptian. He killed the Egyptian and thought nobody had seen it. But the next day he was down visiting, and two Hebrews were fighting each other. One was clearly in the wrong, and Moses rebuked him and said, "Why are you doing this to your brother?" He said, "What are you going to do, kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" And Moses said, "Whoa, no. Somebody knows about this." And certainly a lot of people did. The Bible says even Pharaoh heard about it, and he thought to kill Moses. So at age 40, Moses had to flee from Egypt and live in the desert. He found some girls gathering water at the well for their sheep, and he married one of them. They were the daughters of the priest of Midian, who goes by several names in the Bible. Sometimes he's called Jethro, sometimes he's called Raguel, sometimes he's called Reuel in different passages, but he was Moses' father-in-law. A burning bush, God spoke to him from the bush, said, "I'm going to send you to confront Pharaoh, you're going to let the people go." And so he went and confronted Pharaoh. God did miracles, many miracles, to punish Pharaoh and to convince Pharaoh. Finally, Pharaoh let them go. And Moses led them through the parted Red Sea, and the Egyptians were killed in the sea when they tried to pursue. This then began the next 40 years of Moses' life. His life divides into equal periods of 40. 40 before he ran from Egypt, 40 when he went back to Egypt, and 40 more when he died. So 120 years is the story of Moses from Exodus to Deuteronomy. He led the people. He was leading them to the promised land, which was the land that Abraham and his sons had lived in before they went down to Egypt. And God had promised it to Abraham and his offspring. So they went back. But they didn't get in because they sent some spies ahead who were a little terrified by the inhabitants of the land. So they came back and said, "We can't conquer this land." And God said, "Yes, you can." And they said, "No, we can't." So God said, "Okay, then you can't. I'm going to let you wander around in the desert for 40 years until you're all dead. And then your children will go in." And so Moses led them for that 40 years through the wilderness until that whole generation died. The book of Exodus is where God gave them the law at Mount Sinai. The book of Leviticus is mainly about ritual laws of sacrifice and other rituals of the tabernacle. Numbers talks about their traveling through the wilderness and some of the events that happened to them there. And Deuteronomy is at the end of that period, just before they're ready to go. Moses is about to die in Deuteronomy, and they're about to go into the promised land. And so he repeats the law to them a second time. Deuteronomy means in Greek a second law. It's really just a second repetition of the law to the generation that had come up during those 40 years. Their ancestors, their parents were all dead now. And so the law was given a second time to the second generation. Now, when Moses died, Joshua had been chosen to succeed him. And the book of Joshua, which is the next book, talks about him taking the children of Israel and conquering the land. At the end of that book, we're told, in Joshua 21 anyway, it says that God gave them all the land that he promised. They conquered it, and they dwelt in it, and they possessed it, the Bible says. So God fulfilled his promise. He gave them the promised land. They had to fight wars for it, but they won, and they now had a land that was called Israel. Now, they were now a nation. They actually became a nation before they wandered those 40 years, because at Mount Sinai, just after they came out of Egypt, Moses took them to Mount Sinai. And God said to them, "If you obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you'll be a peculiar treasure unto me above all the nations, for all the earth is mine, says the Lord. And you'll be a kingdom to me of priests and a holy nation." So they said, "We will." He said, "Okay, it's a done deal." So they were now a holy nation. They had only been an ethnic people, a family, a big bloated family at that time, millions of them, but they had not become an entity as they did at Mount Sinai. They became a nation for the first time, and they remained a nation for many hundreds of years. Now, for the first 300 and some odd years of their nationhood, after Joshua died, they had no king. And the reason for that is they were God's kingdom. God was their king. And instead of having an earthly king, they were supposed to be different than the nations, in that they, unlike all other nations, didn't have an earthly king. And so they were to govern themselves according to God's law. Six times in the book of Judges, it says there was no king in Israel in those days. And I think two or three of the times it adds, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, which means that everyone was self-governing. Now, if they were self-governing according to God's law, as they were supposed to be, things went well. If they violated God's law and they self-governed and went evil, God would discipline them. He'd send a foreign nation in to conquer them, to oppress them for a few decades usually. And then they were oppressed and they cried out to God, and God raised up a leader to marshal an ad hoc militia against the invaders, and they drive them out. And then that leader would then, as he was called a judge, he or she, there was one female judge, Deborah, the rest, the other 11 were men. But the judges were not kings. They simply administrated courtroom disputes from God's law. And they did so for the rest of their lives. And when they died, there was no one filled their role, because there was no hereditary offices like in a monarchy. God was their king all the time, and he raised up judges when he needed them. And when they died, they didn't need them anymore until the next time. So that's what the book of Judges is like. And at the end of the period of the Judges, by the way, the book of Ruth, which is next in our Bibles, took place during the period of the Judges. And if people say, well, the period of the Judges, that was really a wicked time. It was not particularly a wicked time. As you add up the numbers of years that the people were obedient to God and the number of years that they were disobedient, they were obedient about three-quarters of the time and disobedient about a quarter of the time. So usually when you read the book of Judges, you think, oh, boy, that was the wild, wild west. Everyone's doing crazy things. Everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. They're worshiping idols. They're, you know, cutting their concubines into 12 pieces and doing weird stuff. And, yeah, they did some of that. But three-quarters of that period of time, called the period of the Judges, which was over between 300 and 400 years, they did right. They did what was right in God's sight. When you do what's right in your own eyes, you can't also, at the same time, be doing what's right in God's eyes. If your own eyes are informed by God's law, and you're doing what's right in your eyes, you'll be doing what he said. That's what they did most of the time. When they went wrong, they had to be punished, and that was about a quarter of the time. But during the good time, one of the good times was when Ruth, the story of Ruth is told. And the reason her story is told is very short, four chapters, it follows the book of Judges, but belongs within the period of Judges, is because she was David's great-great-grandmother. And so David was going to become very important soon, and so the book of Ruth tells a little bit of his family line there. Now, after Ruth are the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. Now, in the Jewish Bible, the books of Samuel were one book. There was just a book of Samuel. There was a book of Kings, and there was one book of Chronicles. In the Hebrew, that could be done, but when they were translated into Greek, in the Septuagint, about 275 years before Christ, when the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew to Greek, the Greek words are a lot longer than the Hebrew words. So they needed more pages for the translation. So they made the book of Samuel into two books, 1st and 2nd Samuel. They didn't call it that yet. They called it actually 1st and 2nd Kings. And then the book of Kings was divided into two, and they called it 3rd and 4th Kings. And the book of Chronicles was divided into two, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And Ezra and Nehemiah was one book. Until then, they divided that into Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, in other words, we have more books in our Bible than they had, but they're the same material. They just, some of the books in our Bible that are two books were only one in the Hebrew Bible. And so, the books of Samuel are about David. 1st and 2nd Samuel are about David's life. Now, at the end of the period of the Judges, the people of Israel came to Samuel, who's the last of the judges, and said, we want you to make us a king to rule over us. And grudgingly, with God's instructions, he did. He made a king for them, a human king. For the first time in hundreds of years, Israel, which never needed a king other than God, now had an earthly king, who's Saul. The name Saul means asked for. And he was the king they asked for, but he didn't turn out well. He was good at first. He turned out rebellious. So Samuel the prophet t- told him, God's rejected you from being kingdom. He's sought a neighbor of yours, a man after God's own heart. He's a better man than you. He's going to give him the kingdom. Now, he didn't tell Saul who that was going to be, but it was going to be David. And God told Samuel to make a secret trip to Bethlehem, which is David's hometown, and to anoint one of the sons of Jesse. There were seven of them, or eight. And the first seven, I think, were rejected. And then they called in David, and God said, that's the one. And he anointed him with oil, which is what he had done when he appointed Saul to be king. He poured oil over his head. That was the inaugural ceremony for a king. And he poured oil over David's head. Now, this is a secret ceremony. Saul was not to know about it because Saul could kill David and would. But the interesting thing is that when Saul had been anointed as king, the Bible says the Spirit of God came upon him. But when David was anointed king, it says the Spirit of the Lord came on David and departed from Saul, and an evil spirit came on Saul. So now we have an evil king actually reigning and a righteous king who's God's real king, who's the real king, but he's not reigning. David's still just a shepherd boy, but he's the actual king of Israel, according to God. But David never pressed his privilege or sought to remove Saul. But eventually Saul became jealous of him, especially after David killed Goliath. And the people were saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his tens of thousands. And Saul said, well, what can he have more than the kingdom? So he began to persecute David, and David fled for several years. We don't know the exact number, while Saul tried to kill him. David and his friends, he had 400 friends initially, and then 600 later. They hid in caves and ran in the desert, and Saul almost caught him several times, and they almost caught Saul a couple of times. Saul was actually at David's mercy once, unbeknownst to him. Saul was dead, was asleep, and David was standing with the spear, could have killed him, but wouldn't. Another time, Saul had gone into a cave to relieve himself, didn't know that David and his men were hiding in that cave, and so David could have killed him then too, but wouldn't. He was going to let God take care of it. And so David and his men fled from Saul for some years. Eventually, Saul was killed in battle, not by David and his men, but by the Philistines. And when that happened, David's own tribe, Judah, asked him to come and be their king. Now, the other 10 tribes were still being reigned by Saul's son, Ishbosheth, who was a weak and ineffective ruler and didn't last long. His own servants killed him and brought his head to David and said, listen, we'll serve you, David. David wasn't pleased by that, by the way. He had been put to death for killing their master. David never had any evil intentions towards Saul or toward Ishbosheth, though for a little while Ishbosheth was David's rival, David ruling over Judah for 7.5 years, and Ishbosheth over the northern tribes. But when Ishbosheth died, then the rest of the Israelite tribes came under David, and he now ruled the whole nation for another 33 years. And he soon moved his capital to Jerusalem, so Jerusalem became the capital city of the country. All right, so now we've got David. David is a good king for the most part. He consolidates his power. He conquers all the nations around that are Gentiles, and they pay him tribute. So he's got a little empire going on there in the Middle East. And he has a terrible moral lapse. We know he slept with his neighbor's wife and then had his neighbor killed to conceal the fact that he'd done so. This didn't go over well with God at all, and God told him because of that, even when he repented, the sword shall never leave your household the rest of your life. So he's going to have an unpeaceful reign for the remaining years of his life, and it was so. One of his sons raped one of his daughters, and then another son, Absalom, tried to kill that son, Amnon, did kill him. And then Absalom had to flee because he killed his brother. And then Absalom came back and tried to get the kingdom from David. And then Absalom got killed in battle by David's general Joab and so forth. So, David's sons were killing each other off. His daughters being raped by them. This is the latter end of David's reign, which was not very good. Even at the very end, he was appointing his son Solomon to be king. But another son of his, Adonijah, wanted to make himself king. And so there was a rival group of military stuff supporting Adonijah in one town. And so David quickly made Solomon publicly king. And so Solomon succeeded him. Now, Solomon was promised wisdom by God, and he was renowned for his wisdom. He wrote over 3,000 Proverbs, and over 1,000 songs. We have about maybe a tenth of his Proverbs in the book of Proverbs. We have one of his favorite songs is the Song of Solomon. We don't know what happened to the rest of them. And he wrote Ecclesiastes when he was old. Now, Solomon went bad. And the Bible says he went bad in Kings. We've gotten through Samuel. In 1 Kings, it says in chapter 11 that Saul married quite a few foreign women. And these women he accommodated by building shrines to their gods in Jerusalem, which was a big no-no. And God promised to another man who was, Solomon was building the temple, and one of the foremen on the project was a guy named Jeroboam. And God said, I'm going to give you 10 of the tribes and take them from Solomon. And Solomon heard of that, so he tried to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam fled to Egypt. Later on, when Solomon was dead, the tribes to the north, you know, summoned Jeroboam from Egypt. He came back, and they said, we want you to be the king over us. But they first promised to serve Solomon's son Rehoboam under certain conditions. Solomon had built many expensive projects. He spent years building the temple. He spent twice as many years building his own palace. And he had pressed the Israelites into hard labor. Some of them were slaves, practically no better than slaves. The nation was it was very wealthy when David left power and Solomon took it over. But it was now financially very depressed, economically depressed, near the end of his reign. And the people, Rehoboam, his son, was approached by the people from the northern tribes. And they said, listen, your father oppressed us. We will serve you if you lighten that load. But if you don't lighten that load, we will rebel against you. And he said, give me a few days to think about this. And so Rehoboam went to the older counselors that were his father's generation and said, what shall I do? And they said, do what these people say, and they'll serve you all the days of your life. And Rehoboam thought, I'd like a second opinion. So he went to the younger counselors of his generation, and they said, oh, no, you don't want to give them the impression they can call the place. You're going to get tough with these people. You tell them, my father, reigned with, you know, he struck you with whips. I'm going to strike you with scorpions. My little finger will be thicker than my father's loins, he said, which is just the way of saying I'm going to be a heavy-handed ruler. And so the people rebelled, and the 10 tribes to the north made it their own kingdom under Jeroboam. And the southern kingdom was ruled by Solomon's son Rehoboam. Now, of course, Solomon and Rehoboam were descended from David. And God had made a promise to David during his lifetime that there would always be a son of David ruling over his people. And there was. Although many of the sons of David were wicked men, God kept his promise, and the next 20 kings that reigned in Jerusalem were sons of David. Now, the northern kingdom, made up of 10 tribes, didn't follow David's dynasty. They appointed Jeroboam, but they had 19 kings in their history, but those kings were all wicked. And they weren't all of one dynasty. The longest dynasty was 4 kings long. There were a couple dynasties they had that were 4 kings long. But most of these dynasties were overthrown by the next dynasty. There was some assassination or a coup or something like that. And so the northern kingdom was idolatrous and under God's threat of judgment for their entire history. The southern kingdom, under David's offspring, sometimes had good kings and sometimes bad ones. If they hadn't had the good ones, they probably would have gone bad thoroughly as much as the northern kingdom did. But the northern kingdom went bad first. Now, God sent prophets to the northern kingdom, including Elijah and Elisha, and of the writing prophets. Isaiah had some things to say to them, though his prophecies were mostly to his own nation, Judah. Hosea wrote to the northern kingdom. Amos wrote to the northern kingdom. And basically, what they were saying is, if you don't repent, God's going to have the Assyrians wipe you out. Now, the Assyrians were a very ruthless pagan power that was rising in the Middle East and conquering all the nations around. And Israel was terrified, because the Assyrians were very ruthless. I mean, they'd skin people alive, they'd disembowel pregnant women, they'd drag people off into captivity with hooks through their noses. They were nasty people. And they had conquered other nations before Israel was conquered by them. And so when they heard that God was going to let them be conquered by Assyria, it was terrifying, but not enough to let them give up their sins. So in 722 B.C., because they didn't repent, the Assyrians did capture Israel, took them into captivity, the northern 10 tribes. The northern kingdom was called Israel after the split. The southern kingdom was called Judah. It was made up of the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin in the south. But the 10 tribes of the north were called Israel. So you had two kingdoms. The northern kingdom was Israel. The southern kingdom was Judah. The northern kingdom of Israel came to an end. Their capital city, Samaria, was destroyed by the Assyrians in 722 B.C. And that was the end of them. They never came back. In fact, they were scattered throughout Assyrian lands and eventually mostly intermarried with Gentiles. So the distinctive Jewish line of the northern 10 tribes was pretty much removed. Now, there were some exceptions, because when Jeroboam had been the first king of the northern kingdom, there were some Israelites in those 10 tribes that wanted to go to Jerusalem, which was the capital of the southern kingdom. And they wanted to worship Yahweh there in the temple, as they always had before. And they didn't like the fact that Jeroboam set up golden calves for everyone to worship in Bethel and Dan. And so people from the northern tribes, we don't know how many, but some, perhaps significant numbers, migrated down to Judah and became part of the nation of Judah. Which means that by the time the northern kingdom fell and was destroyed by the Assyrians, a lot of individuals from all those tribes had now relocated and were living in Judah. They'd been assimilated into the Judean country. So Judah survived after the northern kingdom of Israel was destroyed. But some of the people who had been part of the northern kingdom had already moved south, and they therefore survived. Now, the Assyrians, after they destroyed Israel, they also wanted to destroy Judah. But unfortunately for the Assyrians, Judah had a godly king named Hezekiah, who was under the counsel of Isaiah the prophet. And Isaiah was the main prophet at that time. Micah also was prophesying in Judah at that time. And so Hezekiah, the Assyrians were besieging Jerusalem. They had it surrounded. And they were going to definitely lose. There were three political parties in Jerusalem at that time. There were the pro-Egypt party that were saying, Hezekiah should send messengers to Egypt and have them send armies up to help us drive off the Assyrians, because there was no other nation in the world strong enough to possibly even confront Assyria. Egypt was the one, but they were not very reliable. And then there were those who were saying, we should surrender to the Assyrians. We call that the pro-Assyrian party. There's a pro-Egypt party that wanted to get the Egyptians to help them fight the Assyrians. There's the pro-Assyrian party that wanted them to surrender to the Assyrians. And then there's the pro-Yahweh party, Isaiah being the leader of that party, who said, no, don't seek help from Egypt, and don't surrender. Just seek Yahweh. Well, fortunately, Hezekiah prayed and trusted what Isaiah said. And Yahweh, God, came and he wiped out the Assyrians, who were 185,000 of them were killed in one night by the angel of the Lord as they were sleeping outside the gates of Jerusalem, ready to invade. So the Assyrians losing that many people in one night, they took that to be a bad omen for some reason. And so they decided to retire and go away, and they didn't threaten Judah anymore. So that Assyrian period that swallowed up the northern kingdom of Israel completely, it did not swallow up Jerusalem or Judea. So the Jews, all the Israelites now, no matter what tribe you're from, were part of the nation of Judah. The word Jew comes from the nation, the word Judah. So people were not called Jews yet at that time. It's only later that the people of Judah, when they were taken into captivity in Babylon, were called Jews. And since that time, people of Israeli stock have always been called Jews. So that's where the word Jew came from. But Judah lasted longer than Israel because they had a few good kings. After Hezekiah, there was only one more good one. That was Josiah. And then they were all bad. And God did bring judgment. Again, prophets came to them. Isaiah had warned Israel, but he also had warned Judah that they had to be faithful to God or they'd die. And of course, Isaiah's counsel did save his country for another 100 years. It was 100 years more before they fell. But Jeremiah came up 100 years after Isaiah, and he was saying, there's a new threat, not the Assyrians, the Babylonians. And they were conquering all the Assyrian lands that had been conquered by Assyria. Now they're coming after Judah also. And Jeremiah told his people in Judah, surrender. Surrender to the Babylonians, and you'll go into Babylon. God's taking you into captivity for 70 years in Babylon. This is in Jeremiah 25. And after 70 years, God will judge Babylon, and he'll bring you back, and you can rebuild your temple and so forth, which will be destroyed by the Babylonians. So, now, Jeremiah was therefore seen as a traitor. I mean, here you're in a city, a walled city that's under siege by powerful enemies, and you're inside the city telling the army, surrender, surrender. Well, the prophet's saying that. The king's not saying that. You know, it's up to the king to say surrender, not some clergyman. But so Jeremiah was put in jail, and he remained in jail until the Babylonians destroyed the city and carried the kings and the people off into Babylon. Now, the Babylonian exile happened in three phases. In 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, made his first incursion into Judea, and he didn't conquer the city, but they couldn't resist him either. He didn't destroy it. He just took some captives back to Babylon with him. Those captives included Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. We read their story in the book of Daniel, of course. And they were taken into Babylon in 605 B.C. Now, about 11 years later or so, the Babylonians came back, and he took some more captives. He still didn't destroy the city at that time, but Nebuchadnezzar took some more captives. He took the king of Judah and some other captives with him, and among those were Ezekiel. Ezekiel was taken into captivity in Babylon about 11 years or so after Daniel and his friends were. So Ezekiel and Daniel were prophets in Babylon in the exile during the 70-year exile. Now, later, after the last king of Judah had been deposed by Babylon, he'd been replaced by a governor named Gedaliah, whom Nebuchadnezzar set up to rule the remaining people who were in the city. And he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar came down and wiped out the whole city and took everyone else into captivity and destroyed the city, destroyed the temple, burned it down. That was the end of the Jewish state. It didn't exist anymore for 70 years, approximately. And so all the Jews had been taken into Babylon. They had a few prophets there. They had Daniel there, and he was elevated to actual political influence as well. He counseled some of the kings, the Babylonian kings, and even the Persian kings that conquered Babylon. And then there was Ezekiel, who was prophesying from the time he was taken into captivity that Jerusalem was going to fall to the Babylonians. That's what most of Ezekiel is about in the first half of his book. The second half, Jerusalem had fallen. So, I mean, his ministry is kind of cut about in half by before the fall of the city to Jerusalem, to Babylon, and afterwards. Now, he was in Babylon the whole time himself, but there's still a city in Jerusalem operating until 586 B.C. And then Jerusalem ceased to exist. The nation of Israel ceased to exist. They were all in captivity. Now, Isaiah and others had prophesied that there would be a man named Cyrus. Isaiah 44 and Isaiah 45 talked about this man. So I didn't even name him 100 years before he was born, 150 years before he was born, and said that Cyrus would release the captives from Babylon and would send them back home to build their temple again in Jerusalem. Now, he did that. Cyrus was the Persian king, and the Persian media, Persian Empire conquered Babylon in 539 B.C. And one of the first things that Cyrus, the Persian conqueror, did was he issued an edict that all people from other lands, including the Jews, who had been taken into captivity by the Babylonians, could go back to their original lands, including the Jews. So a man named Zerubbabel, who was descended from the royal line of David but was not a king, he was made governor. And there was a high priest named Joshua, and these two community leaders, the governor and the priest, led 50,000 of the captives back to Jerusalem. And that story is told in the first part of the book of Ezra. Now later, another leader of the Jewish community, a priest and a scribe, came from Babylon. He didn't go with the first group, but he came back to Jerusalem to help the people reestablish the religion after the temple had been rebuilt by Zerubbabel. And so the book of Ezra has the story of Zerubbabel's mission and of Ezra's mission. The book of Nehemiah, which was originally part of the same book as Ezra in the Jewish Bible, is about another man who later came from Babylon, a Jewish man. He had not been able to go with the others because he was a slave in the Persian king's palace. Artaxerxes at this time was the Persian king, and Nehemiah was the cupbearer. Now, a cupbearer was somebody who would taste the wine for the king before the king drank it to make sure it wasn't poison. One of the easiest ways to assassinate somebody those days was to poison his wine, and kings knew that, so they had a servant who would taste the wine before giving it to him. And Nehemiah was the cupbearer to Artaxerxes. And so he was in that position, but he heard about the state of Jerusalem still being in ill repair, and he was sad about it. And Artaxerxes said, "What are you sad about?" He said, my people are in disarray. I'd like to go back if I could and help set things up there. Their walls are burned down and they need their walls rebuilt." And so Artaxerxes very generously said, "How long will you be gone? I'll give you the materials so you can go back." And so Nehemiah went back and helped the people build the walls again, because while they had been gone in Babylon, the local, as they were called, Samaritans, local, what we call them Arabs probably, had been in the area and they resented the Jews coming back, and so they resisted the Jewish rebuilding of the temple and the walls. So eventually in Nehemiah's time, the walls got completely rebuilt, and Israel and Jerusalem were restored. And so all the prophecies of the Old Testament that said that Israel would go into captivity and come back from captivity and be reestablished as a nation were then fulfilled. And no other predictions were ever made again afterwards. So when people tell you, what's happening in Israel today is fulfilling these prophecies. God said he's going to send them into all nations and bring them all the way back and build the nation. Yeah, he did say that, and he fulfilled it 500 years before Christ. There were no other predictions of it. So there's no predictions about the end times about this. People who say that simply are ignoring the context of the prophets. These prophecies were made before the Babylonian exile or during the Babylonian exile, but they were not made after the nation had become reestablished again. So there are no additional prophecies about that after that time. Now, the last of the prophets, there were three prophets who spoke to the exiles when they came back, to the regathered people. Two of them were Haggai and Zechariah, and they prophesied while the people were rebuilding the temple. The people were discouraged by the opposition they were getting from the locals, and the prophets were given words from the Lord that God is on your side, he's going to help you be successful, get to work. And they did, and they built the temple under the counsel of Zechariah and Haggai. The only other prophet God gave in Old Testament was Malachi. And he came also after Jerusalem had been rebuilt. And actually, he came at a time when the people in Jerusalem were becoming lackluster in their zeal for God. They become kind of lukewarm, because they were bringing sacrifices to the temple, but they're bringing blind and lame animals. Now, you're supposed to bring a flawless animal. That's what the law said. You bring an animal that doesn't have a spot or a blemish on it, much less a broken leg or a missing eyeball, And so what they were doing is offering to God things that were worthless to them, because a lame or a blind lamb would die anyway. Oh, we'll just give God this one, And so basically they were still worshiping God, but they were compromising and basically not making any real sacrifices. They had no zeal for God. They also were divorcing their wives. Malachi had to address that. They were also complaining because although the nation of Israel had been reestablished, it wasn't as glorious as they thought it was going to be. And so they're saying, it really isn't it's not worthwhile to serve God because, he hasn't really rewarded us as much as we thought he would. And it turns out they weren't paying their tithes. So the priests were going hungry because the priests and the Levites lived off the tithes of the people. So Malachi came along and rebuked them for that. Said, "You need to stop offering inferior animals. You need to stop holding back your tithes. You need to stop divorcing your wives." And that's the last Old Testament prophet, the last Old Testament book. Now, There was then 400 years before John the Baptist came, which means there's 400 years between the Old Testament's close in Malachi and the New Testament's open in Matthew. 400 years. We call that the intertestamental period. Now, although the Bible doesn't record any of the history of that period, it does mean nothing interesting happened. No prophets were speaking, so no inspired books were written. To write an inspired book, you have to be a prophet. And God didn't send any prophets after Malachi until John the Baptist came. So there's 400 years with no prophets from God, but not 400 years with no activity. Because 330-something years before Christ, the Persian Empire, which was the empire that had sent the Jews home from Babylon. When the Persians conquered the Babylonians, they let the Jews go back. Well, the Persian Empire was conquered by the Grecian or the Hellenistic Empire under Alexander the Great. Alexander came to power after his father Philip of Macedon went at age 20. And in 12 years, he conquered the whole world, which meant the Persian Empire at that time. And then he drank himself to death and died of syphilis, too. And when Alexander died, who was the huge military success, he had a few sons, but they were murdered by his generals because they didn't want him to have success. They wanted each of his four major generals wanted to control his empire. So they fought each other. And they couldn't beat each other, so they divided it up four ways. And of the four ways, I mean, there are four generals, Cassandra and Lysimachus, I think was the name of two, that don't come into the biblical story. But other two are Ptolemy and Seleucus. Now, Ptolemy took over the Greek Empire in Egypt that Alexander had conquered. And Seleucus took over the portion that was in the Middle East, what we call the Levant, or, you know, Israel and the Arab countries around there, as we now know them. Seleucus was Syrian. He was a Greek general, but he ruled over the Syrian portion of Alexander's empire. Now, the problem here was that Syria was north of Israel and Egypt was south of Israel. And Syria, under the Seleucid dynasty, and Egypt, under the Ptolemaic dynasty, both wanted to control the whole area, so they waged war with each other. And the problem was, they couldn't just shoot missiles at each other and skip Israel altogether. They had to march through Israel to get to their foe. So armies were continually going back and forth through Israel. And Israel wasn't even involved in the, didn't have an interest in the thing. But these armies would plunder and rape and so forth the Israelites as they go through and rob them and stuff. So Israel had a really hard time there. And at one point, in the beginning, Israel was under the Ptolemaic dynasty of Egypt. And things didn't go quite as badly for them under that. But when the Seleucids came and conquered them, one of the Seleucid rulers was named Antiochus IV, who is known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means something like illustrious. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. His enemies called him Antiochus Epimenes, which means Antiochus the madman. And he was a very cruel guy, sort of a Hitler type of character. And very cruel to the Jews. He took control of Israel, which is why he's important in the story. And he tried to wipe out the Jewish religion. He sacrificed a pig, an unclean animal, in the Jewish temple, defiling it so that the Jews wouldn't worship there because it was now defiled. He forbade possessing a copy of the Torah, which is the scriptures, and he forbade the observance of Sabbath and of circumcision. All those things were commanded to the Jews, so a faithful Jew could not avoid keeping Sabbath or avoid circumcising their children, nor would they give up their scriptures. And so there was a resistance group, religious resistance group in Israel, called the Maccabean Revolt is what it was. Maccabean comes from the name Maccabeus, which is the name of a man. But here's how this came about. There was the Hasidic Jews were unwilling to stop circumcising, stop keeping Sabbath. They were they resisted the Syrian oppressor Antiochus, and they were slaughtered. They wouldn't even lift a weapon to defend themselves on the Sabbath because that's bearing a burden. So they were just slaughtered by the Assyrians. And there was a faithful priest in a little town called Modin in Judea, or maybe it was in Galilee. I forget exactly where Modin was located, but his name was Mattathias, the priest of Mattathias. He had four or five sons. And a Syrian official set up an altar to a pagan god in that village in Modin and commanded the priest to offer a sacrifice to this pagan deity. He refused to do it. And before anything else could happen, another Jew stood up and offered to do it and said he'd do it. The priest killed that Jew for treason and then killed the Syrian official. And then he and his sons fled into the wilderness where they set up a guerrilla band of militants. And they had a lot of sympathizers who joined them, so they became sort of like Robin Hood's Merry Men in Sherwood Forest. They would run raids against the Syrian troops that were occupying. Now, the temple had been defiled by this pig, and the Jews were not using it. And they would not use it till they could cleanse it. The revolt of Mattathias and his sons lasted for about 3 years. And Mattathias was killed. Most of his sons were killed. The leader of the group eventually was his son, Judas Maccabeus. Why he's called Judas Maccabeus, nobody knows. The word Maccabeus means the hammer. And there is a theory that it was because of his effective crushing of the enemy that he was called the hammer. There's actually one theory that it was the shape of his head that made them call him the hammer, which I don't know what shape his head would have to be for people to call him the hammer for that reason, but we can picture a hammerhead shark, but it's probably not quite so pronounced as that. But his name was the hammer. And the revolt came to be named after him. It's called the Maccabean Revolt. And eventually they defeated, by their guerrilla warfare, they defeated the disciplined troops of the Syrians and drove them out. And Antiochus Epiphanes couldn't control the area, so he gave them their liberty. And then they rededicated the temple. Every year, when most Christians are celebrating Christmas, the Jews are celebrating a feast called Hanukkah. And that's celebrating this victory. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. When the oppressors were driven out and the Jews wanted to rededicate the temple, they needed the special oil that Aaron was to make, according to the law, to relight the lamps. And the candelabra there, they had the lampstand with the seven lamps. And they didn't have enough oil. And it took a while to make it. I forget how long it took to make it. A week or something? I forget. It might have taken a week to make it. But anyway, they had a little bit. And according to the story, God allowed this little bit of oil to last till the new oil was made. Miraculously, it was like it burned 7 days instead of 1 day. And so that's why they have the candelabra, with the seven branches where they light it at Hanukkah. That's still celebrated. That feast is called the Feast of Dedication in John chapter 10. We're told that Jesus was in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication. That's what we call Hanukkah today. So that's the institution of that feast is not mentioned in the Bible because it happened in the intertestamental period when there were no books of the Bible written. But there's an apocryphal book called First Maccabees. It tells that story, and that's not an inspired book, but it's a book that tells that story pretty accurately. So, anyway, then there arose certain camps. After the Maccabean victory, there was actually a dynasty of priests, Jewish priests, that took over as kings, and they were called the Hasmoneans. And there was more intrigues, assassinations, coups, and things like that. Until the Romans came and conquered the region in 70 B.C., or 63 B.C., I think it was 70. But the Romans, when they took over, appointed Herod to be the king of the region, and he was still ruling when Jesus came. He was a wicked guy. He had another Hitler type of guy, too. He was very evil. He's the one who killed all the babies in Bethlehem under 2 years old, but that wasn't the only thing he did. He killed a lot of his own sons and one of his own wives, because he thought they were plotting against him. So his killing of the babies in Bethlehem was very in character for him. He thought the king of the Jews was born. He didn't want there to be a rival king of the Jews. Herod was the king of the Jews. So that's why he wanted to wipe out Jesus. And he killed as many babies as he thought would get the job done. And he missed it. missed the baby he was looking for. But Herod did kill quite a few of his own family members because he thought they were plotting to take his throne. And when he was dying of a horrible, gross, sickly disease where his entrails were coming out and stuff like that, he knew nobody loved him, nobody would grieve his death. So he arrested 1,000 of the leading citizens of Jerusalem, put them in custody, and told his servants, the day I die, kill these people so there'll be mourning in Jerusalem on the day I die. But even his servants didn't love him, so they released him instead. When he died, they let these people go. Now, when Herod died, his sons kind of divided up much. Herod Antipas was the Herod who arrested and killed John the Baptist. Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, was ruling over in Galilee, and John the Baptist was rebuking him, and he arrested and killed John the Baptist. Herod Antipas, just Antipas? No, okay, Antipas, no, let's see, Archelaus. Herod Archelaus was reigning down in the Judean area. And when, remember, Mary and Joseph had fled to Egypt because of the threat of the babies being killed. When Herod the Great died, they came back from Egypt to Judea and found out that Archelaus, son of Herod the Great, was ruling there. And the Lord said, don't settle there, because Archelaus was removed soon after by his abuses. And they went and grew up under Antipas, Herod Antipas, who was in Galilee. Now, there were some other Herods in other regions, but they don't come into the story because they're not in Israel. Anyway, so Jesus was born at that time. Now, the first four books of the New Testament tell about the life of Jesus. Only two of them mention his birth. That's Matthew chapters 1 and 2 and Luke chapters 1 and 2. And then they move immediately from his birth to his adult ministry, with the exception that Luke has one story in Luke chapter 2 about Jesus' childhood, or we might say his bar mitzvahhood. There's no mention of his being bar mitzvahed, but when he was 12 years old, he made a trip to Jerusalem. It seems like it may have been his first trip to Jerusalem. Boys under 12 didn't have to go when the other Jewish men did. And anyway, that's the only story of his youth. And then, you know, the Gospels just skip over all the other youth until he's 30. And John, he's baptized by John. Then he starts his Galilean ministry and so forth. Now, I'm not going to go through the story of Jesus. I mean, it's in all the Gospels. You've read it, I hope, or can read it. I'm just kind of surveying what's in the Bible. The Gospels, all four Gospels, tell the life, or at least the ministry, of Jesus up through his death and resurrection. And they mostly don't mention his ascension. Mark does in the longer ending of Mark, but there's some people think the longer ending of Mark is to be disputed. But Acts was written also by Luke as a second volume to his gospel, and he tells us about the ascension of Christ, and then and the Great Commission given to the apostles and so forth. And so the book of Acts then tells about how the church continued after Jesus was gone. The day of Pentecost came 10 days after Jesus rose from the dead, and the apostles began to preach. Thousands in Jerusalem began to be converted. We don't know how large the church in Jerusalem became before Gentiles started joining too, but we know the first recognized Gentile convert was Cornelius. Peter visited his house under angelic direction, and the Holy Spirit fell on them. Maybe around that time, we're not sure exactly when, Saul of Tarsus, who was persecuting the church, met Jesus on the road to Damascus, became a believer, and Jesus commissioned him to go to the Gentiles. He was the first apostle specifically commissioned to go to the Gentiles. Peter did go to the Gentile house of Cornelius and led him to the Lord, but Peter's recognized in Galatians chapter 2, it says Peter and the other apostles recognized they were sent to the circumcision. And Paul and his team was sent to the uncircumcision, that's the Gentiles. And so the book of Acts begins mostly talking about Peter and John before Paul's conversion. And Peter is the main apostle in the church initially. And he's arrested by Herod Agrippa I, in Acts chapter 12. And he's put in jail to be put to death, but angels spring him from jail, and he escapes and leaves the area, and we don't know where he goes. He disappears pretty much from Jerusalem. He's only seen there one more time, And that's in chapter 15, after the danger's over and they have the Jerusalem Council. Peter's seen back in Jerusalem there, but he went somewhere else for a number of years. In the meantime, Paul became, his ministry began to be followed. Now, some people, you know, think Paul must be the greatest apostle because he's the one there's the most about. But one reason there's more about him than others is because the story of the early church was written by Luke, who traveled with Paul. Luke didn't travel with Peter or James or the others, so he didn't write down what they did. He wrote down what Paul did. And so certainly the second half or more of the book of Acts is about Paul's ministry. And it ends in chapter 28 with Paul awaiting trial for his life. Nero was then the emperor. Paul had been falsely accused of doing things that are supposedly capital crimes to the Jews, and he'd managed to appeal his case to Caesar to get away from the Jews who wanted to kill him. And he eventually was tried by Caesar, but the book of Acts closes before that trial takes place. Paul arrived in Rome under custody and under house arrest, and he remained there for 2 years, and then the book of Acts ends. At some point after that, he stood trial before Nero. And there's some evidence in the epistles that he was acquitted the first time, especially 2 Timothy seems to say that he was acquitted the first time before Nero. He traveled some more in the Mediterranean world, left Titus in Crete, left Timothy in Ephesus, and did some things like that. We don't even read in the book of Acts if Paul ever going to Crete, but after Acts was closed, after the story was up, the book was closed, he apparently was released, traveled some more. He was arrested again later, according to church tradition. He was beheaded by Nero. So that was the end of Paul. And each of the apostles came to similar ends, with the one exception of John. All the apostles died as martyrs. But their martyrdom is not recorded, except for Peter's is predicted in John chapter 21. James's martyrdom, James, the son of Zebedee, dies in chapter 12 of Acts, and Paul's martyrdom is not recorded, but he's, you know, on trial for his life when the book ends. But we have stories from the church fathers who knew the apostles, or who knew those who knew them, that all the apostles except John died as martyrs. John lived longer than the others, and near the end of his life, he or sometime in his life, he had the visions on Patmos that became the book of Revelation. Now, the other books between Acts and Revelation are just letters that Paul wrote to some of his churches. And the founding of these churches are mentioned in the book of Acts as you go through Paul's story. He made 3 major missionary journeys. On the first of these, he converted the Galatian Christians, and he wrote the book of Galatians to those churches in that region. His second missionary journey, he ventured into Greece, and he founded the Philippian and the Thessalonian churches, and the Corinthian churches, and he wrote letters to them also later when he'd left them. He spent some time in Ephesus, 3 years, and it would appear that later when he was in prison, he wrote letters to the Ephesians and the Colossians and to Philemon, who was also a Colossian man, an individual, and the Philippians. So he wrote letters from prison. We call those his prison epistles. Now, at the very the last epistles Paul wrote are the ones we call the pastoral epistles. When he was very old, he was apparently at liberty when he wrote 1 Timothy and Titus, though in 2 Timothy he was writing from prison. And it's not his first imprisonment in Rome, it's his second one. So he apparently didn't survive that one. That's the one where Nero put him to death afterwards. So now, when Paul writes 2 Timothy, he mentions, my time is up. I've run the good race. You know, henceforth is waiting for me a crown of glory. You know, I'm poured out like a sacrifice to God. I'm ready to go. And so 2 Timothy was the last epistle he wrote. Now, Paul probably didn't write Hebrews, though some have attributed to him. Hebrews is anonymous, so we don't know who wrote it. Many theories exist. No sense in us talking about them now because we can't prove any of them. Even the early church fathers said nobody knows who wrote it for sure. There's some credible theories. Some think that Barnabas wrote it. Some think that Luke wrote it. Some think that Paul wrote it in Hebrew and Luke translated it into Greek. Some believe that Aquila, or Priscilla, actually Priscilla wrote it. There's no good case for it. Luther thought that Apollos wrote it. Now, but Origen, a church father in the 3rd century, said, when it comes down to Hebrews, nobody but God knows who wrote Hebrews. But whoever it was traveling with Timothy, which means they were part of Paul's company at some point, because Timothy traveled with Paul incessantly. And in the end of Hebrews, the writer says, know that our brother Timothy is at liberty, with whom I will visit you if he comes. So we know that it was someone from the apostolic circles, and that's why the book of Hebrews came to be included in the canon. The books of Peter, we don't know when Peter wrote them. Many people think Paul was dead by the time Peter wrote them, though Peter was killed shortly afterwards. The reason is that Peter's writing his first epistle to some of Paul's churches. It's not clear why Peter would write to Paul's churches unless Paul was no longer able to do so. There's 3 epistles of John. They could be the latest books written in the New Testament. We don't know. The book of John may compete for that position. But they are written to undesignated areas. John does not identify what area he wrote 1 John to. 2 John is addressed to someone called the elect lady, who is not identified. Some think that's a church. Some think it's an actual woman. And then 3 John is written to a guy named Gaius in a church we don't know where he was. Jude, then, is the last of the epistles in our collection. And Jude was a brother of Jesus, just like James was. James wrote to Jewish Christians. We don't know who Jude's audience was, but he lifted heavily from 2 Peter. And Jude looks like it's a sermon written by one of Jesus' brothers, Jude, that used 2 Peter as a text. He also quoted from some apocryphal books like Enoch and the Assumption of Moses and stuff. So that's how the whole New Testament came. Now, some people think the book of Revelation was the last book written. There's no reason to believe it. It appears last in our Bible simply because it's a unique book. It doesn't fit the other categories. It's not one of the Gospels. It's not a history like Acts. It's not an epistle like Paul. So it's an apocalyptic prophecy. It's the only New Testament book of that type. So it's positioned last just because there's no other category to insert it into in the New Testament. But it's not necessarily the last book written. I think John wrote it probably before he wrote the Gospel of John and before he wrote the Epistles of John. I talked about that previous months when we talked about those books. So that's the story of the whole Bible.